طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. We spend a good deal of time on This Week in Palestine, analyzing and exposing the efforts of the Israeli lobby to counter attempts by Palestinian organizations and voices to educate and organize on behalf of the Palestinian people who dare to resist the occupation of the Palestinian homeland by the Israeli military. One of the major efforts of this Israeli project is the censorship of speakers, forums, and organizing efforts by pro-Palestinian organizations on U.S. university campuses. It also includes dark money from the far right, using censorship techniques to advance the far-right agenda and silence criticism from the left. It has penetrated the classroom as well as other campus forums and extracurricular activities. Today we examine this phenomena through a webinar held at UMass Boston featuring three of their professors, Heike Schotten, Leila Farsak, and Andrew Leon, joined by Trinity University professor Isaac Kamalov. Professor Heike Schotten begins with introductions.
Welcome, everyone, to We Will Not Be Silenced, The Repression of Academic Freedom and Resistance, from Leila Khaled to UMass Boston. I'm really excited to be here. I'm really glad for our amazing panelists. I'm really happy to see so many people in the audience attending. Welcome. And this is the first time for me managing a webinar in exactly this capacity. So your patience in advance is requested, and I have much gratitude for it. My name is Heike Schotten. I'm Associate Professor of Political Science at UMass Boston. I'm going to be the moderator, the facilitator for this event. I am going to first give a little background and context as to how we came to be here in this Zoom room together. And then I am going to introduce our panelists. So I'll just begin then. The first thing I want to say is welcome. I'm really glad that you're all here and that we're all here together to think and talk together about these really important issues that couldn't be more current and more important. A little background as to how it is that we came to be here. A month ago today, on September 23rd, two professors at San Francisco State University scheduled a webinar, what they called an open classroom webinar. They were two faculty, one in Arab and Muslim ethnicities and diaspora studies, and one in women's gender sexuality studies. They combined their classrooms together and held an open classroom webinar with 12 invited guests, one of whom was Leila Khaled. And we will find out more about who Leila Khaled is from one of our panelists today. But needless to say, There were many people who did not approve of Leila Khaled being given a platform to speak at SFSU. Many outside Zionist organizations and Israel lobby organizations, and they swiftly organized a campaign to get the webinar shut down. They petitioned the university, I think with little success. And at that point, they turned to Zoom and petitioned Zoom and demanded that Zoom get rid of or somehow stop this webinar from going forward. Zoom was responsive to this pressure, and they sent a letter to San Francisco State University. We have not seen the letter, so we don't know what the letter says. What actually ended up happening on the day of the webinar, at the moment it was supposed to begin, the Zoom link did not work. And it seems that the webinar, I don't know if the webinar was deleted, but no one could access, no one in the audience, none of the attendees, none of the hosts, no one could access the webinar. It was gone. The tech team supporting these two professors regrouped, managed to get the webinar onto YouTube. They began streaming the webinar on YouTube. The outside agitators, the Zionist and Israel lobby groups, then flooded the report function on the YouTube video. And within about 20 minutes, YouTube pulled the plug on the webinar and stopped it entirely. At the same time, Facebook scrubbed tens, if not hundreds, of references or mentions of the webinar event from people's Facebook pages and accounts. Okay, so we had an enormous collaboration, multi-corporate collaboration to engage in censorship of this webinar and the restriction of academic freedom. And to our knowledge, the university, San Francisco State University, did not put up any resistance or try to stop Zoom from exercising this kind of authority and power over faculty at a university. So this is a pretty major political moment. It's a pretty major act of censorship and abridgment of academic freedom, not to mention a direct attack on any kind of advocacy for Palestinian or indigenous liberation or anti-colonial struggle. In response, an organization that I'm part of, US ACBI, the US Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, we called for a national day of action, which is today, 1 month from the original webinar. On October 23rd, asking that faculty anywhere host webinars of their own featuring conversation with Leila Khaled, conversation about Leila Khaled, and conversation about attacks on academic freedom, social justice and liberation movements on our campuses, and the corporatization of the university, and our unfortunately our university administration's complicity with the corporatization of the university and the silencing and restrictions of academic freedom and liberation movements. There's approximately, I think there are 10 or 12 webinars scheduled that are happening today around the world. There's one happening in the UK, there's a couple happening in Canada, and there are many happening in the United States. One of them has already been censored. It was scheduled to take place at the University of Hawaii. Zoom, we did get the letter that Zoom sent their university. Zoom sent a letter to the University of Hawaii administration and said, you have 24 hours to respond. This webinar is in violation of our terms of service. And if it goes forward, you will be in violation of your contract with us, Zoom, and we will cancel our contract with you, the university. And the university did not want its contract with Zoom canceled, and the webinar was deleted. And the organizers did not delete it. Zoom deleted the webinar. So one of today's webinars has already been censored. Luckily, that has not happened to us here yet at UMass Boston. But that is what we're here to talk about today. We're here to participate in this day of action and to learn more about the attacks on our freedom, on the freedom of Palestinians, and on all of our academic freedom and right to study and inquire and speak. So with that, I want to introduce our panelists and sort of say what the agenda is for today, what we're going to talk about. We have three really, really fantastic speakers with us today. First up will be Leila Farsakh, who is Associate Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department here at UMass Boston. She's going to tell us a little bit about Leila Khaled, who she is, and put her in her historical context, in the context of a larger Palestinian struggle for liberation. After Professor Farsakh, we will hear from Associate Professor of Political Science, Isaac Kamola, who teaches at Trinity College. He's a professor of international relations, and he is going to tell us a little bit about a recent area of his research and expertise, which is the fact that the kind of attack that happened at SFSU on this webinar is actually part of a much larger phenomenon that's taken place over decades in the United States. Of a very well-funded, he should tell you, right? But a very well-funded, well-coordinated right-wing attack on higher education, on anti-racist education, on academic freedom. And he's gonna tell us the details about that and help us make the connections between what happened at San Francisco State and the University of Hawaii and what has happened to our own faculty here at UMass Boston. And in that vein, we will hear also from Associate Professor of Philosophy, Andrew Leung, who is going to talk about an experience that he has had of being targeted by these orchestrated, well-funded outside right-wing organizations and their attempts to get faculty disciplined, surveilled, punished, fired, et cetera. Before I turn it over to our amazing panelists, there's one piece of this webinar that is an essential piece that's part of the Solidarity Day of Action. And it's about the education and outreach that we are doing about Leila Khaled, who she is. Leila Khaled, unfortunately, could not be with us today. We had hoped that she would. She's very much in support of these webinars, this Day of Action happening. She knows about it. She's given her blessing. And we had hoped that she could record a message to us. She was unable to do that. And so we have compiled a very short video, 5 minutes long, of Leila talking about Palestinian resistance and so-called terrorism. And so I'm going to show that video. And then after that, I'm going to turn it over to Leila. Let's see how this goes. Okay. I'm going to share my screen with you all. I'm going to ask that the other panelists mute yourselves so that the only sound is coming from my computer.
We are not afraid of struggle. We are afraid of giving up. Our people never gave up in the past, and not now, and not in the future. It's because we have supporters all over the world.
I think a freedom fighter is a part of a people who are struggling for their freedom. Many resistance movements in the world, including South African resistance, was described by the West that this is a terrorist act. The most dangerous thing is when it is a state terrorism against the people. What can we speak about occupying Palestine by the Israelis and not abiding by international law to withdraw, and yet Israel is going on with its occupation? This is a state terrorism against the people. So when we speak about terrorism, we speak it in terms of occupation, apartheid. And in Palestine, there is occupation and apartheid system in Israel. This is terrorism, while resistance is illegal and recognized and experienced means for a people to get their freedom.
They tell us, you are the Palestinians are terrorists. Imagine that the colonialists call the Palestinians who were driven out from their homeland and that they are the terrorists. While occupation, they don't mean it, or they don't say that occupation is the peak of terrorism. The whole world suffered from colonialism, but it ended in many countries. We remember Vietnam, we remember Algiers, we remember South Africa, we remember Cuba, we remember all the struggles of peoples for liberation and for freedom. We have used all means of struggle, and we are still determined to continue using all means of struggle, including armed struggle. Whoever would tell us that this is not your right, I will tell them, go back to history. Go back to history and go back to the United Nations Charter. The international community recognized that people under oppression have the right to resist. I'm optimistic about the historical victory that we will achieve with you, with your support, with this solidarity, with going to BDS, boycott, divest, and sanctions against Israel to isolate this apartheid state. When it's isolated, it is the first step towards victory.
With that, I'm going to turn this over to Professor Farsakh. Leila.
Thank you, Heike, for organizing this. Thank you for all the organizers and also for all the attendees. I'm really impressed that so many people have made it. I think this is a very important meeting because it touches at the heart of what academics do and what in this country is considered a freedom of speech. Because this assault on Leila Khaled and on any talk about terrorism is problematic at more than one level. Because I think people need to understand that the point here is to contextualize what Leila Khaled did. And when is it that people revert to what some call terrorism, or what we also call in the discipline, violent act? It's important to remember that Leila Khaled, when she is known to have been the one who hijacked the planes in 1968 and 70, which made the Palestinian cause visible to everybody. This act was very important because it came in a context where the Palestinian people were not only simply negated, but also did not exist. It came after two wars, the war of 1948, when Palestinians were expelled from their land with the creation of the State of Israel, and after the war of 1967, which was the second war that expelled more Palestinians from their land and enabled Israel to take control of the West Bank, Gaza, as well as Golan Heights and Sinai. It was a moment particularly bad for the Palestinian cause because when attempts were made to come up with a resolution, a United Nations Security Council resolution to try and find a solution to the Israeli-Arab problem, it completely excluded the Palestinian from the picture. UN Resolution 242, which becomes the basis of every peace settlement in the Middle East, it's the basis of Israel and Egypt's peace treaty, the basis of Jordan and Israel peace treaty, and above all, the basis even of Oslo, which is the peace treaty between Israel and the PLO. This resolution 242 negated the existence of the Palestinians. It does not mention them by name. It mentions also that peace would be based on what is called the land for peace formula. In other words, Israel is supposed to give back land in exchange for being recognized by Arabic states. And only mentions the refugee as a humanitarian problem, not as a political problem. In other words, it excludes other UN resolutions which were central to the question of Palestine, including the partition plan of 181, and including the right of return, which is 194, which was voted in 1948 with the support of the United States. So in that context of the catastrophe of 1967 war and the problematic nature of UN Resolution 242, the Palestinians felt they not only were they defeated, but they were being negated. And I think the act of Leila Khaled has to be understood in that context, because it's only by a violent act such as kidnapping planes that Leila Khaled and the party she was part of wanted to put the Palestinians on the map. Now, it's important also to remember that these acts of violence are not the same thing as September 11. People in the United States, when they associate or think of terrorists, they think of September 11. They think of irrational acts of violence to kill people for the sake of killing people. As we know today, terrorism is never an irrational act. It's actually a rational act. The general convention it is the tool of the weak. It's not so much the tool of the weak as well as the tool of the silenced. And I think the Leila Khaled and her hijacking of planes was very important to point out how much that act was an attempt to tell to the world that the Palestinians exist. Their aim is not to kill people. The hijacking of plane was never about killing people. Actually, nobody was killed in any of the hijacks apart from one of the hijackers that was with her. The civilians were not attacked. It was meant to be a stunt. And it also meant to be a stunt in two very important ways. The first one, to assert that the Palestinians exist, that they have a right to resistance, that armed struggle is legitimate, that it's a struggle against what Leila Khaled calls in the video state terrorism, because colonialism is terrorism. It's the United Nations has declared colonialism as a crime. And also it was a way for Leila Khaled to assert that Palestinian women and Arab women are actually agents of their history. It's very important not to undermine that very important symbolic and feminist agency in Leila Khaled, what Leila Khaled represents. She represents, she defies the image that the West had of the Arab women as a passive, scared woman. She represents an active agent woman who takes her destiny in her hand, who represents her cause, represents her individual wish for dream, her, for freedom, as well as the collective right of Palestinians for freedom and return. And also, it is a time when we should not forget, as she pointed out also in the video, when we had successful or supported rebellion in Vietnam against what was at the time called American imperialism, which we know today still exists. It was emulating the Algerian liberation struggle against French colonialism. It was a time when armed resistance was considered legitimate because it was trying to assert rights and because it was trying to assert existence at the time of negation. And in that respect, I have to say, I know it's very, people insist, like, why can't you go into nonviolent resistance? I think the history of armed resistance in general and violent acts, if we look at all various political parties, national movement, anti-colonial movement, violent acts is what puts you on the map. People, it's not everybody has the privilege of not being violent. And Palestinians were able to go into nonviolent resistance once the world was able to see them. I think this is something that we need to bear in mind because terrorism and violence is a result of an act of oppression. It's rarely an act of violence for the sake of violence. And definitely, Leila Khaled's message and approach has been about using a tool, in this case, armed resistance, to assert Palestinian women and Arab women and the Palestinian cause right to exist. So I'll stop at that and I'll let others intervene. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Leila, for that. That was really helpful. Next, I'm going to turn it over to Professor Isaac Kamola. Hi, Isaac. Go ahead. Thank you. Welcome.
Great. So thanks so much for inviting me to participate. And thanks for Leila for an amazing talk and Heike for organizing this event. This is a really important conversation to be having. My area of expertise is looking at right-wing attacks on academics and following the money behind what has become a very professional, very well-funded outrage machine that has very real political consequences for individual faculties that find themselves in the crosshairs of organizations like Campus Reform, but also for universities that and colleges that have to bear the brunt of these attacks, and as well as our broader public trust and understanding in higher education as an institution, the kinds of silencing of academic freedom that takes place. So basically, the project that I'm currently working on is called Campus Reform First Responders. And basically, Campus Reform is an organization. I'll explain a little bit more who they are, but they write articles like the one on the screen here that basically gin up outrage over various things that faculty members say. Currently, there's a lot of stuff of Campus Reform reporters sneaking into Zoom meetings like this one, or illegally recording classes, as happened at UMass Boston recently. And then writing stories that are based on ginning up outrage over what things that that faculty members have said. And so basically, as part of the, and oftentimes what happens then is that these stories move from Campus Reform to other websites or like Breitbart or Daily Wire, Daily Caller, and sometimes make themselves to Fox News. And then they can mobilize huge outrage machines where people call in and put a lot of pressure on universities and academics that can lead to retaliation against faculty. So basically what the project does is we monitor the website every day. And when we see a faculty that's been attacked by Campus Reform, write an email to the professor telling them, about the story, but also explaining who Campus Reform is, who funds them, and what their broader political intention is, as a way to basically give people preemptive understanding of what's going what's happening, because these things can kind of take on a life of their own. Life is going along, and then all of a sudden, boom. So basically, our argument is that you need to follow the money, that you need to understand the money structure that is put in place around these attacks on professors. So what I'm going to do today is run through one example of how this broader right-wing political infrastructure has been created to attack Palestinian activists. So for example, there's this story from May 27th about Professor Abdulhadi at San Francisco State University, who received a AUP award. And the story goes on to basically repeat a lot of the of the arguments that we just heard about, the kinds of arguments about that she's a terrorist, promoting terrorism, et cetera, and that it's unacceptable that the AUP gave out this award. So what we do is, when a story starts to, when a story gets written, what we do is we put a Google alert on it, on that person, and we find out where that story is traveling. We found that story started to pick up steam. So these are all the places that story about Professor Abdulhadi's and receiving the AAUP award, kind of all the different places where these various kind of outrage stories were posted. Many of them were almost identical. The one from the Middle East Forum, 527, is actually quoted Campus Reform. The ones that I highlighted in red here are all organizations that are part of this kind of right wing attack structure. So let me just walk through kind of how this works. So the first, there's a few Jewish newspapers that came out, and the Middle East Forum Campus Watch, which is the part of the Middle East Forum that kind of monitors campus activity, then published four stories on this. And if you look at the funding behind the Middle East Forum, you see a number of kind of actors that are huge in funding these attacks on professors. Donors Capital Fund and Donors Capital Trust are two organizations that are called donor pass-through entities. So rich billionaire, oftentimes Koch, people in the Koch donor network will give money to Donor Capital Fund, and then that money will be channeled into various organizations after being anonymized. So it's a way to kind of pass through anonymous donations to organizations. Donors Trust and Donors Capital Fund are two of these pass-through organizations that are very closely tied to the Koch donor network. The Bradley Foundation, very conservative foundation out of Wisconsin that is responsible for Scott Walker and a bunch of other funders of ALEC and a lot of other organizations, again, within the Koch donor network. The story also traveled to the College Fix. The College Fix is kind of a smaller version of Campus Reform. Receives money from the Charles Koch Foundation, as well as Donor Trust, Donor Capital Fund, as well as other organizations that are part of the state policy network, the JM Foundation, John William Pope, Bradley Foundation. And what the state policy network is, it's an organization that the broader Koch strategy works by having a bunch of seemingly autonomous organizations and entities, right? So you have think tanks that appear to be acting independently. You have a think tank in different states, state level think tanks, as well as ALEC, as well as the Federalist Society, as well as Americans for Prosperity, and a whole bunch of different kinds of organizations. Young Americans for Liberty are all part of the state policy network, which becomes the organization that kind of organizes strategy among all these different entities, right? To make sure that these organizations that appear to be broadly distributed throughout social society are actually working together in an organized and coherent way. And again, if you look at the funders behind the state policy network, you'll see it's exactly of the same funders that are funding these organizations. The College Fix, like Campus Reform, does a similar thing where it publishes outrage stories about faculty. Campus Reform is an organization that is part of the Leadership Institute. And according to tax documents in 2018, the Leadership Institute had a budget of $16 million. A lot of that, as you see, comes from Koch Foundation, Bradley, Donor Trust, and other organizations that are organized through the state policy network. And basically what the Leadership Institute does is it trains campus activists and brings students for trainings. It produces alternative curriculums. And then it also trains journalists. And then Campus Reform becomes the kind of a playground, the kiddie pool in which right-wing journalists get their practice, right? So, and then a lot of the people who are then correspondents for Campus Reform go out to Fox News, Wall Street Journal, whole bunch of other, and Breitbart, a whole bunch of other news outlets across the right wing media ecosystem. So basically, Campus Reform trains conservative activists for the explicit purpose of going back to campus and raising hell, especially on issues around free speech, and uses Campus Reform as a tool of basically monitoring and harassing faculty. So basically they pay students about $50 was the last reported number per story. The Leadership Institute has college chapters across the country. And oftentimes it's people in those chapters giving tips to Campus Reform, people monitoring Twitter and Facebook, and maybe even here on this forum, who knows? We'll find out in a few days, I guess. And so basically Campus Reform is again funded by the same folks. And then again, you see the Clarion Project also ran a story about Professor Abdulhabi. And again, the Clarion Project is also funded by Donors Capital Fund, as well as Sheldon Adelson. And you'll see that the same groups that are funding these organizations have a long history of funding organizations that the Southern Poverty Law Center describes as anti-Muslim hate groups, right? So one of the things that this group of radical libertarian right-wing donors that are integrated through organizations like Donor Trust and political networking organizations like State Policy on Network, they do many, many different things. They fight against labor unions. They fight against the social safety net. They fight against minimum wage. They are largely responsible for climate denial. And they're also funding these organizations that not only spread Islamophobic and Islamic hate, but are also actively attacking professors, including those who are advocating for justice in Palestine. So I'll stop there and happy to answer any questions at another time.
Thank you, Isaac. Thanks, that was incredibly helpful. And I guess I just wanna make sure, if you can stop your screen share, Isaac, that would be great. You're working on it, okay, sorry. I just wanted, in case the connection has not been made, Professor Rabab Abdulhadi was one of the organizers of the San Francisco State University webinar that was shut down a month ago today. She's been the target of a long-standing, ongoing fight, a series of attacks by outside groups and Zionists, exactly as Isaac explained. A few details that I neglected. So as you've noticed, we don't have a chat box. If you have questions for our panelists, put them in the Q&A box and we'll try to get to as many of them as we can after our panelists are finished speaking. And with that, I want to turn it over to Professor Leong.
All right, thank you. I want to say that I'm a little bit wired right now because I'm going through a little bit of PTSD as I was prepping my notes for today. And then hearing Isaac's presentation, you know, I just kept on nodding myself. Okay, yes, yes. Now I understand how heavily I got hit back in 2017. Let me just lay out some basic background information for you first. March 19th, Sunday, 2017, the day before we come back on spring break, I receive at 8 a.m. in the morning this email from the provost. Dear Professor Leong, the provost's office has received reports in the plural form, reports of classroom conduct by you that may be in violation of the state conflict of interest law. In accordance with the State Ethics Commission's advisory 11-1, public employee political activity, and then the advisory opinion is quoted, which I won't bother to read to you. And then the second paragraph says, you are hereby summoned to meet with me as Dean of Faculty at the following times, either next Thursday or next Friday. Notice that in this email, not once were any particular allegations about what the violation consisted of. Which class was it from? Which day in which class? Okay, and obviously by Monday morning, not just by Monday morning, but throughout that Sunday into Monday, I started contacting people from the union. I contacted people from external, my friends at the ACLU. I contacted, you know, essentially I didn't have to work for that week because I was prepping for this summoned meeting that was going to be taking place on a Friday. Okay. On the Monday, I responded, yes, I will attend on Friday, but can you tell me what the specifics are of the charge? Because otherwise, it'd feel like, you know, there's a due process violation that's going on here. What am I going to do? I have taught at this university for 27 years. Can you tell me at least which particular semester we're talking about that I violated some sort of a conflict of interest law? Nothing. I get no response back from the administration. I lawyer up friends from the ACLU, my wife, you know, they're at this crucial time period, post-inauguration 2017, where most lawyers, we are locked at the airport trying to figure out the anti-Muslim ban, right? Trying to represent people. So instead of doing that, I'm taking valuable advocacy, legal advocacy time away from good friends, my wife, ACLU members, to help my ass out in this, okay? This is the situation where now we're talking about the internalized weaponization of the right, where after the students get trained, you know, going through these particular orientations at campus reform, they now sit in on your classes. And in that particular semester, I was for the first time teaching this intro course in philosophy that was entitled, what the hell was it called? Moral and Social Problems. So as you can see, it was obviously ripe for, you know, everything that was happening on a contemporaneous basis was ripe for me to talk about in class. And so, you know, but yet at the same time, you know, there were no specifics in the charge. And I could only guess because by that point in time, I had already received numerous threats, death threats by email, by phone calls, what have you. It had, you know, started to die down a little bit. So that was the only way that I could identify that was something that happened. What happened? Well, the facts are the following, that following the inauguration, there were all sorts of various different protests that was happening around the country. Not only that, but within the UMass system, by that point in time, President Meehan, as well as our chancellor at that point in time, issued proclamations against the president on the anti-Muslim ban. And so there were protests happening throughout campus, and I just happened to notice there was another protest coming up, and I grabbed some leaflets, and at the beginning of my class on social and moral problems, I said, hey, y'all, look, there's this protest coming up, okay? If you want to go, and scream your lungs out, you can. The leaflets are here for you to pick up if you're interested. Boom. That's it. Stop. And then went into the class that I've been dealing with over the course of many weeks, which is about John Stuart Mill and the marketplace of ideas. And at the same point in time in that particular class, I had talked about the Rule 19 sanction against Senator Warren because she was attempting to protest in the Senate the nomination of Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. And she was going to read off a statement that was written by Martin Luther King's widow. And she was sanctioned. She was prohibited from doing so. And so this is the confines of what I was attempting to do, about the First Amendment, about the free exchange of ideas. And so I essentially said, yes, this is an association with my announcement. And not only that, but a week or two after, I also made another announcement, and not just an announcement, but I said, there's this other event that's happening in class. You all remember Martin Scorelli, that stock exchange guy that turned pharmaceutical CEO, and then the minute that he owned the pharmaceutical company, he upped the price of one of the drugs by 5,000%, okay? He was invited on campus by one of our right-wing student groups to speak. And again, only in this class, not in my other class, I made the announcement to say, we are not, I'm going to actually let class out early in order for you, some of you all, to attend if you're interested. Why? Again, because it is relevant to what I was covering. But I'm still trying to figure out, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, what the specifics of the charge is when I'm meeting on Friday. Never got a single response from the provost's office. By Wednesday afternoon, I said, I'm still waiting to hear the specifics of the charge, okay? If you don't get back to me, my lawyer and I are going to just have to postpone the meeting on Friday. By Thursday, somebody else within HR got back to me, essentially saying that this is an informal meeting. No lawyers are allowed. So essentially saying that, Professor Leung, you're going to have to lawyer up yourself. Did they specify what the charges are again? No. Throughout Thursday, I'm lawyering up. Not usual, not unusual for a lawyer. I went into the meeting on Friday, and the first thing that came out of the provost's mouth was to say that, we're kind of sorry, Professor Leung, that you are here. I see online, because I went to Campus Reform already, saw the clip of what you did, and understand, the various different punishment external to our campus that you have received may have already been sufficient. As you could gather, I was extremely pissed by that point in time because I felt that I did not a single fucking thing wrong. This is my goddamn duty to be teaching what I'm teaching, okay? This is a class on moral and social problem, and what was happening through our country is exactly relevant to that particular class. And it is not just a violation of my academic freedom, but I am doing a disservice by not focusing in on those particular topics, You know, when, you know, when everybody else is talking about, you know, philosophical and historical things that's out there, we got a ripe battleground outside that we're not going to teach, that we're not going to relate the relevance to our students. That is absolutely absurd. So number one, first and foremost, the right has weaponized our administration so that, you know, they have armed themselves to understand what are the local laws. And here, the general counsel within UMass has simply overestimated this conflict of interest law. And not only that, but the provost herself, you know, she is not a lawyer. I am a lawyer. Did she read the statute? I read the statute. And not only that, but Massachusetts General Law Chapter 55 was really about campaign fundraising. Do I, as the person that is supposedly having a conflict of interest, am I going to have some sort of a monetary gain from this activity? No, I did not. It is about the exchange of information of what is happening outside of our campus. And so, you know, here, I think they have totally overutilized this conflict of interest law and without understanding contextually why we are doing what we are doing. What, you know, what is the content? How is it related to class? Insofar as all the other external things, all the hate mails, the threats, I can deal with that. I have dealt with that before, okay? But what I could not stand is how the administration didn't bother to give me the time of day in just little details as to why I am being brought in, okay? You can even leave out the name of the complainant. I probably, yeah, I know who the complainant was because if I went to the Campus Reform website and looked at the video and looked at the article, that very student was actually quoted, which is a total violation of the anti-wiring statute in Massachusetts, okay? So at the same time that I'm brought in, they're using this particular information that they ought not to be using in the first place, okay? So why is one particular state statute, you know, more powerful than another statute? And not only that, but the information that was being quoted was simply from an advisory opinion about what the interpretation of the statute meant, okay? It was just totally overblown, but I wanted to make sure that people understand this is the kind of context and how administrations throughout the you know, not just Massachusetts, but throughout the United States are now being weaponized by the right in order to create chaos, you know, for us to disable us from teaching what we are teaching. I am not, for one, going to go the safe route and talk about history and not touch all those things that are relevant for us. You know, the only thing that has made me do is to embolden me to continue to talk about what is relevant and what are the duties that we all need to perform as citizens. Okay, with that, I know I got to shut up and let's take it back to Aiken. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew, that was incredible. Thank you so much. And I have to say, on UMass Boston specific detail, despite multiple attempts to educate the current administration about precisely these issues, this has not prevented them from nevertheless proposing in bargaining with the faculty staff union to increase punitive language in the academic freedom clause of our collective bargaining agreement and to add to academic freedom, academic responsibilities, wherein we must comport ourselves with dignity and integrity. So I think these are live issues and they're currently live with this administration on our campus.
You have been listening to a webinar recorded at UMass Boston, exploring the current threats to free speech and academic freedom and silencing of the Palestinian narrative on campuses across the United States. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
من مخيم إلى بلد مهجرين.